Welcome to the premiere episode of the comics that we love. My name is Zach McCrary, and I am very excited to bring this podcast to you. It has been a labor of love getting to sit down and read comic books with my friends and then get to deep dive into the stories and the art and really have the opportunity to gush about a medium that I have loved for most of my life. Today, I will be discussing the DC Comics property Mr. Miracle by Tom King and Mitch Gerards, along with my good friend and fellow podcaster Mr. Adam Brinker from the show Beyond Caring. He's a very intelligent and witty guy and brought to the table one doozy of a book for us to sink our teeth into for episode number one of the show. Just as a reminder, before we pop the lid off the long box and pull out our issues, you should know that this is a very spoiler-filled show, so if you've never read Mr. Miracle and don't want the story ruined for you, now would be a good time to go and buy it from your local comic shop and binge-read it before resuming the episode. Another warning for you, my dear listeners, is that this book deals with issues of depression, suicide, and the horrors of war, so if any of those things make you feel not so great, you might want to hop to another episode of the show. I'll totally understand. Now, without further ado, let's get to it. The inaugural episode of The Comics That We Love, Mr. Miracle.
Up in the sky, look!
That we love.
Adam Brinker, welcome to the show, sir.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I am very much looking forward to talking about this book tonight.
And I have been looking forward to talking with literally anybody about this book ever since I read it.
Wow. So why is that? What was it about this book that when I came to you and said, choose a book, let's read it and talk about it, why did you choose Mr. Miracle?
As I'm sure you and some of our listeners might be aware of, I'm a big fan of Jack Kirby and specifically the New Gods.
Okay.
I remember getting them on digital a while, like very, very long time ago, back when I didn't have a lot of money to throw around.
Mm-hmm.
And just being completely floored by everything that was happening in that world. I had never read anything like it, like from that era. It, despite the fact that it was a part of the DC universe, it felt completely separate because, like, all this larger-than-life stuff was happening and there was no Superman, there was no Batman, there's only these ridiculous figures going through these, like, throes of ultimate passion and life-or-death situations and nonstop, you know, movement. And it was just, it was like a shock to the system. So fast forward a couple years, they had that New Gods omnibus come out, which
is enormous.
Or the Fourth World Omnibus, I'm sorry, but yeah, because it's not just the New Gods, it's all of the New Gods adjacent material, and I bought the living hell out of that. And as I read through it, I got to experience all the different materials. So, like, they had New Gods, the Forever People, all of Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen stuff, which is...
It's so weird that is included in the New Gods stuff.
Like, or like the first half. The second half is, eh. But, and most importantly, Mr. Miracle. And after reading through the whole thing and kind of, you know, sitting on it, digesting it, I kind of settled on, like, you know what? I came into this being a huge New Gods mark, but I'm kind of exiting this thinking that New Gods is not the best thing Kirby ever did. But my personal favorite became Mr. Miracle because it was, instead of being a very self-contained story, it was very open. He took a lot more risks in terms of writing and artwork and experimentation on, like, that artwork.
Okay.
I saw the most breaks in the traditional 9-panel structure of comics in Mr. Miracle. Like, there's one scene in particular where I think,
and we're talking Kirby Mr. Miracle, right?
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah. Where there's a thing called Overlord, and it's like, the entire page is actually done up like a comic, but it's from Overlord's point of view. And it's like Overlord is the comic book reader looking in on Scott Free.
Ooh.
I had never seen anything like that. And I was like, at this point, I'm into like indie comics.
Right.
But here's Kirby pulling new rabbits out of the hat. That's 50 years ago.
That's something that I would equate more to an Alan Moore in the 80s kind of book.
Yeah, and so Mr. Miracle won me over because he's a very upbeat hero. You get all the upsides of having like weird like B level new gods show up and screwing around with him, and Kirby's taking risks left and right because it's not like his big magnum opus. It's kind of his, well, let's get weird with it stuff.
That is really, really interesting, especially pointing out that he is an upbeat hero, because that is the antithesis of what we are going to get tonight. So I guess we should just dive right in then, shall we?
Yeah.
Okay, so first and foremost, this obviously is not the Jack Kirby run of Mr. Miracle. We are reading the 2017-2018 Tom King book with art by Mitch Gerads. And now I'm going to tell you a bit about the author and the artist. The limited series is 12 issues long and based around the stories of the New Gods, as we've been talking about, created by Jack Kirby in the 1970s. And Tom King is our author. Tom King is a former member of the CIA turned writer who has been acclaimed for his work on Marvel's book The Vision, as well as Mr. Miracle and the Vertigo comic The Sheriff of Babylon, which is also worked on with Mitch Gerads.
Oh, yeah.
You're familiar?
I am, because Mr. Miracle was wearing a Sheriff of Babylon shirt in one of the issues.
Oh, I totally didn't even think about that. Yeah. That's great. Where was I? Oh, yeah. So he also worked extensively on Batman recently. A lot of issues of Batman and the DC event Heroes in Crisis. Mitch Gerads is an artist who spent the first chunk of his career working in the packaging industry, oddly enough, specifically illustrating for recognizable cereal brands such as Cookie Crisp, Trix, Lucky Charms, and so on. He co-created and illustrated the comic Johnny Recon, and has done art on varying forms, lots of covers on Batman, Heroes in Crisis, Mr. Miracle, The Punisher, Irredeemable, Black Widow.
Another great book, by the way.
That's what I keep hearing. Black Widow, Doctor Who, The Flash, The Activity, Sheriff of Babylon, Starborn, and many more. The two men have become a duo who are synonymous with one another in the modern day comic scene, and are currently working on the maxi series Strange Adventures, which tells a story about DC character Adam Strange. On that book also is artist Evan Doc Shaner, who is known for his retro comic book style art. And it's really interesting, the clips that I've seen, because they kind of go back and forth between the two art styles.
I see.
Because Gerads is very different than like a retro comic-y style.
Right.
So, yeah, the two of them, it's a very interesting juxtaposition. Oh. That's a little bit about the men responsible for this. Interesting things of note. Tom King says that the idea for the story of Mr. Miracle arose after a severe panic attack that landed him in the hospital in 2016. He said that upon leaving the hospital, the world felt different, slightly off, and then things in the world really did change to the point where he felt like he no longer recognized it as the world he grew up in. The story also deals a lot with loneliness and PTSD specifically.
Yep.
And the idea that it feels as though no one else in the world could possibly relate to what you're feeling. And it touches on what it is to be family, the horrors of war, and the fear of change and the inability to escape it, among other heavy, heavy things.
Yeah, this is possibly one of the most, I don't want to use the term dark, but
bleak? No, you know.
Not even bleak, though. It's just frank.
That is a good way to put it.
It is a frank discussion on what it's like to be a god, what it's like to fail as a god. It's what it's like to be in war, what it's like to be an adult, and what adult decisions are.
Yeah,
this is the possibly most fully realized adult graphic novel I think I may have ever read.
I would 100% agree with that. The things that are touched on in the book and the way the two worlds that Scott has put himself into, meld together. He tries so hard to keep them separate, but it's just impossible.
Yeah.
And the way that those worlds meld together and all of these things that he has to take on that he doesn't necessarily want to, but is just, it's thrown into his lap and he has to make it work.
Yeah.
It really is. It's just, if you break it down in a lot of ways, it's a book about being an adult and having to make decisions.
Yeah. And sometimes you have to suck it up and do a lot of things you do not want to do.
Yeah, man. Yeah, absolutely. So this book deals with a lot of not only Mr. Miracle, but it brings in a lot of the New Gods characters from back in the day. And Tom King puts his own twist on all of them. So Brinker, would you mind just telling everybody a little bit about the New Gods? For those who aren't familiar with the characters, we've kind of touched on it a little bit, but could you like really give us an idea of the New Gods?
Yeah. So basically the New Gods are Jack Kirby's take on what would a new mythology be? One that doesn't have ties to, you know, Norse mythology or Greek mythology or any like specific geographic region or culture or history.
Okay.
It's just everything. He made a pantheon of good and evil completely out of nowhere, basically. So you have the race of the New Gods. You have the denizens of New Genesis, which have devoted themselves to everything good and chaste and all that stuff, led by High Father, and there's countless other ones. And then you have the denizens of Apocalypse, which are currently ruled by the fascist dictator known as Darkseid. And beneath him, there are all the comically, ridiculously stylized villains.
Oh, yeah. Kalibak.
Yeah. Kalibak, the half-troll, Kanto the assassin. Vermin Wunderbar is one of my favorites.
Vermin Wunderbar. Yeah. What a great name. Was that the guy that was peeing off the side with Scott?
No, that was Kanto.
That was Kanto?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But yeah. And so you have all these characters that are much like, you know, the Greek and Norse gods of old in terms of attitude, but all of their motives are different.
Right.
And it's very much like a modern mythology, because instead of dealing like, oh, what's Zeus going to screw this week? it's basically an eternal war against the forces of life and growth and creation versus the embodiment of fascism looking for a way to subjugate free spirit.
Because Darkseid throughout all of this is looking for something called the anti-life equation.
Correct.
And what exactly is the anti-life equation supposed to be?
There's never been like a really dedicated thing to it, but basically it's the ability to, I mean, I the closest we ever got was in, I believe, Kirby's Forever People towards the end, where they found somebody who was kind of dabbling with that. They found a human mind capable of tapping into it, where it's basically, it's the ability to erode free will and replace it with your own.
Upon some reading, apparently, within, I guess, the after Kirby, Scott Free does learn the full anti-life equation.
Okay.
And
I don't count that stuff, though.
You know, anything non-Kirby isn't canon for you?
No. I mean, because I tried to read them, and it just wasn't the same.
Oh,
like,
wow.
They really dialed back a lot of the things that really made those comics special after Kirby left, I feel.
Okay.
That's just me.
Being a New Gods purist, it makes sense.
Yeah.
I totally get it. Mr. Miracle. So let's talk the backstory of how he is Mr. Miracle, what he's gone through, and how that leads to the beginning of this book.
Yeah, so Mr. Miracle, also known as Scott Free, he was the son of High Father.
Mm-hmm.
And when New Gods started, both New Genesis and Apocalypse were in a period of truce. And that truce was won by High Father and Darkseid trading their firstborn sons.
Okay.
And basically signing a pact, say, a non-aggression pact. Scott Free was the son of High Father, traded to Darkseid, and the being that became known as Orion was traded to High Father, and that was Darkseid's son.
Okay.
So while Orion, you know, grew up in New Genesis society, living the lap of luxury and like becoming, growing up, being encouraged and cared for, Scott Free was, or actually, it's never even known what his name was.
That's right.
And we'll get into that later.
Yeah.
Was taken by Darkseid and thrown directly into the X-Pit.
The X-Pit.
Which was ran, which is an orphanage ran by good old Granny Goodness herself.
Oh, what a hell, Granny Goodness. What a great character.
Yeah. Which, if you've never seen Granny Goodness, she is a matronly, kind of chubby old lady wearing scale mail armor, and she is a full-on sociopath.
Oh, yes.
Like Kathy Bates in Misery with children. her orphanages exist to do two things. Decide who is tough enough to live life on Apocalypse, because if you can't survive her orphanage, you're not going to survive anything. And to essentially brainwash people into service of Almighty Lord Darkseid. And, you know, probably also Granny.
Probably also, yes. That is kind of the idea of this character that we get in the Tom King book, is him dealing with all of the trauma
yes.
that came from living in the X-Pit
yeah.
with Granny Goodness.
And like back even in the Kirby issues, like his whole character's motivation was he became an escape artist. Like because he would, you know, Granny would constantly chain him, imprison him, do countless unspeakable things to him, but he would always find a way out. And that's what it was.
And that's how he earned the name Scott Free, because she said that was basically, he was always trying to break Scott free. Right?
Right. Yeah. Right.
And how did he get the Mr. Miracle moniker then?
He came to Earth, or he escaped, when he actually finally escaped Apocalypse. He came to Earth and ran into an actual escape artist, friended him, and then, you know, typical superhero origin story.
Mm-hmm.
Thugs show up, kill him, mantle his past.
Right.
And that's how he earns his life, basically.
Interesting. Okay. Working off of the X-Pit and everything that he went through growing up, all that trauma, that kind of leads us into the beginning of this book. Which, by the way, folks, if you're feeling overwhelmed by all of this New Gods talk, the book actually does a really great job of just condensing it down at the beginning and giving you a brief synopsis of all of what we were just talking about.
Yeah, like it literally, like, I think it's like also like two or three pages, gives you a quick rundown. And then a lot of these characters, you do kind of, you can pick up what their deal is. It's both a boon and a downside to a lot of New Gods characters. They are all somewhat one, like most of them are pretty one dimensional.
Right. Yeah, that, for me, not knowing any of the New Gods characters really outside of names and faces other than Darkseid,
mm-hmm.
it was still easy for me to get an idea of, okay, this is who this is. This is the way he is. Like you said, a lot of them are kind of one dimensional by design, probably in Tom King's case, just to get across who they were,
right.
how they affect Scott, and so on and so forth. At the beginning of this book, there is such a crazy striking image. Like the way that the book starts is so interesting, because the first thing that you see is just a picture of Scott, like no mask, just sitting there. And we get some words directly from Jack Kirby. Jack doing the intro from the original Mr. Miracle number one. And we get just a kind of a serene look on Scott's face.
Oh, yeah.
Full splash page. And as we jump to the next page, it's a two-page splash where he is seen having attempted to commit suicide, bleeding out on the floor of his bathroom.
Right.
What a striking image and a striking way to start this book.
And that's how all of these issues like start. Like they all like that. And that's another thing that really, really kind of hit me home, like emotionally as well, is like you have these overwrought, like almost Stan Lee-esque, you'll never believe what's going to happen in the next issue, kids.
Yes.
So while this utterly bleak and depressing, or like these very deep emotional impact scenes play out, and they still kind of tie together too. So it kind of elevates this book into this weird way where it keeps reminding you that it's a comic book.
Mm-hmm.
So like right like at every point where there are these big emotional beats and you're getting really invested in the story, it's saying like, and just remember, none of this is real.
Yeah, it's such an interesting take, because of, like you said, you've got these bombastic lines coming straight from Kirby. And like, for instance, there's the issue where it ends with Big Barda giving birth.
Right.
And everything that's being said is just, this is such a normal, like, fact of life. These normal facts of life things are happening, or at the end of a chapter, it's something terrible, but the things that Kirby is saying are supposed to excite you and make you want to read the next issue.
Yeah,
but it's just something visually depressing or visually shocking. You know, it's never it never quite lines up, but it does.
Yeah,
in a weird way.
It's almost like the byline is aware of what's happening, but it doesn't know how to handle that it's a comic book.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, actually, on the same line as the bombastic words straight from Kirby, there is a character in this book that is totally Stan Lee.
I was wondering if you picked up on that.
Yeah.
Funky Flashman.
Funky Flashman. Yeah. Is that a character from Kirby's books?
It
that
is.
Was totally a knock at Stan?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Funky Flashman was an invention that he did straight from Mr. Miracle.
Oh, wow.
And this is a post-Marvel Jack, so...
He's a little bitter.
Funky Flashman's whole deal was he was originally a Mr. Miracle villain because he was essentially trying to trap Scott Free into contracts.
Oh my.
And showmanship.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
That is a direct punch at the nuts.
Yes.
Oh, Jack.
Yeah. And this book makes it like if it wasn't obvious enough before when Jack was very bitterly writing about that, this book just beats you about the face and shoulders.
Yeah, yeah. Tom King absolutely takes advantage of that character and uses him in very interesting ways that I found quite amusing.
Oh, absolutely. Like
eventually making him a nanny and so on and so forth. But yeah, it's so clear that it's a play on Stan Lee, especially when every once in a while he just screams out Excelsior.
Yeah, well, that was...
or True Believers.
I think a lot of that is because, like, for the modern audience that may not be aware of, like, the whole back history of everything that happened,
it's like,
you kind of have to be like, hey, this is a thing.
Yeah, yeah. This is a Stan Lee parody.
Yeah.
Make sure you understand that.
Yeah.
But yeah, away from a Funky Flashman, let's talk a bit about the attempted suicide and
yes.
where that all comes from, because that really is the first half of this book is him dealing with that a lot, trying to come to terms with his past and what it's done to him and who he is because of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the first, like we said, the first image you see is just him serenely, like, basically looking back at you, like almost as though he's looking, quote, at the camera kind of. And he's clean shaven and he's, you know, he's got the pristine jawline. And as this book goes on, I love that his beard slowly grows out.
Yeah.
To the, like, he's, you know, it's almost like he's pushing out all the negative energy that he's feeling and all the negatives to the point where by the end he's able to cut it all off and be okay with life again.
Or even just the, like, you know, it could be a symbol for, like, yeah, he's alive because he got saved, but he doesn't care enough about himself to...
Oh, absolutely.
To, like, take care of himself, and it's once he actually starts caring about his personal appearance again, that he's actually recovered, but, you know, at what cost?
At what cost, yeah. So one of the interesting things about this book is also the fact that he is married to one of the other new gods, Big Barda.
Yes.
And that they both were products of the X-Pit.
Right.
In different ways, whereas... You know, obviously he was not always meant for the X-Pit, whereas she was just born, bred like that. That is all she knew for a long time.
She is a literal child of Apocalypse. Yes.
Yes. And it's interesting listening to their conversations about their experiences in the X-Pit and how different they were.
Right.
Even though they were both experiencing, because they'll be talking about something that happens and then the other will say, oh, I remember that too. She, you know, Granny Goodness did that to me as well. But when it happened to me, it was a little different. And it seemed like Granny kind of took care of Scott a little more than maybe she did Barda in a way. And so Scott's remembering all the things that he felt, and Barda is kind of laying it out like, you know, other people have had it worse, and it seems like. Did you get that
absolutely.
Vibe?
Well, and a lot of that can very easily be traced to two things. The fact that Barda has always been a no-nonsense, you know, very, very tough exterior type of, like, live life as it is person. You know, she's very direct. There's very black and white. There's no really moral gray areas with her ever. Whereas Scott is more touchy-feely, he's more empathetic, he's, you know, he's the artiste. And then on top of that, you also have to remember, there was nothing special about Big Barda when she was growing up. She just happened to survive the hell that she was put through. Whereas Scott Free was the child that kept the truce alive. He had to be, he was special. And so everybody knew he was special. And so that, and whether that, that fed into his ego or fed into his rearing, like, they couldn't just let him die necessarily.
Right. And so he got special treatment from Granny.
Yep.
Yeah. That's the scene where you first come across Granny Goodness again, when they are there to talk. I believe it was like peace talks.
Peace talks, yeah.
And just the conversation between her and Scott was so, it's kind of weird because, like you said, Granny is a sociopath. She likes to torture people, mm-hmm. and the way that she is talking to him is as though it's this sweet old granny who used to bake you cookies, and she loves you, and she misses you. You know, why don't you ever come by anymore? And when it comes down to it, Scott is not able to take care of her. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. Barda comes in and just lays down the law and just murders Granny Goodness.
Right. Well, and you also have to remember, like, how that... Because they bring her up a lot as the comic goes on, surprise, surprise. But the other thing you have to remember about Granny Goodness is that that character is selfish. She cares for others because she wants to elevate herself.
Mm-hmm.
So when she is talking to Scott and, like, talking like a mother, she's not doing so out of love. She's doing out of self-interest. Because at this point in the comic, Scott is the leader of an opposing army. She's trying to get into his head, and it's working.
Mm-hmm.
Because she knows that she showed him
empathy
and kindness, that he remembers that. He values that more highly than she does. She's exploiting those emotions.
She's exploiting his new genesis-ness, yes. Basically.
And because that's what she does. And remember the mirror scene later when Kalibak gives him, was it the mirror of goodness?
Oh, where you see the truth of yourself or something like that.
And yeah.
He and Barda are actually able to see the damage that was done to them by goodness.
Right. Yeah. And you have to remember, because like, she would show both of them like what she had done to them every night and say, like, remember, you're mine. That's absolutely chilling. Like, it's like straight up like domestic abuse type stuff.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
But like very literal, because you're seeing like your completely altered body, just like you're a walking corpse, and it's how you feel on the inside because of this person.
Right. And when Barda comes in and just smashes Granny's head in, it really does show what we were talking about before, that Scott got this, you know, he is easily manipulated because he got this special treatment. Barda is a full product of the X-Pit with no remorse for this killing.
Yeah, it's like she fights wars. Before she, fled Apocalypse with Scott Free, she was a female Fury, which was an elite female combat task force where literally all they do is just murder things.
Let's talk a bit about the contrast of these crazy characters with these weird costumes and their nutty worlds of the fourth world, and the juxtaposition with that and just the absolute mundane normal Earth world.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's one of the most interesting things about this book, is how easily Tom King and Mitch Gerads are able to take these things and jump back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Because you were talking about the Furies, it made me think immediately of while Barda is in labor,
yes,
and her sisters show up, which is the other Furies. I don't know their names. Do you know their names?
Oh, gosh. Stampa, Lashina, Bernadette, and I never...
Bernadette.
And I never remember the weird clawed jungle lady.
Well, three of them show up to the hospital because of the baby. And
right.
Then they're in the middle of this war between New Genesis and yeah. Apocalypse. But there on Earth, it's kind of like a neutral ground.
Right.
Where even though they're at war with the two, with Scott and Barda, they're there because their sister's having a baby. And it's like the first baby of its kind, because
right.
it's a product of New Genesis and Apocalypse.
Or just a female Fury having a child.
Or that, not, yeah.
And actually creating life as opposed to taking it.
And the conversation that happens between Scott and them is so interesting, just because the setting is so normal. And then you see these crazy characters going back and forth, trying to have a normal conversation. You know, there's no
yeah.
Other than the one that speaks in riddles and is creepy. And it's a very normal humdrum conversation.
Like, right.
How is she doing? Is the baby close? Da 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 da. By the way, I'm still going to kill you later with this knife, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's she's related to Desaad. There's a whole other thing with that line, yeah.
and the fact that she gives that knife. What are they called? The Farron knife?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, because Barda's skin is too tough to be cut with a normal instrument. And the fact that the doctor needs to use that to deliver the baby.
Right.
Doing things like that, it's such an interesting thing that he's able to do. Why do you think Tom King decided to make that juxtaposition happen?
Well, it's a lot of that is just showcasing what makes Mr. Miracle an interesting character, right? So he is a literal god who lived in heaven or whatever this new mythology's equivalent is, or had the opportunity to live in this mythology's equivalent of heaven.
Right. On Mount Olympus, yeah, if you will.
Essentially. Or, you know, he was raised in hell, decided that he didn't want to be a part of this never-ending struggle of people constantly being at war, like at 100%, and dying and feeling emotions. So instead he chose to run away. He chose to escape and just live his life as nobody.
Right. Which is, he's kind of a perfect entryway to the new gods, because of the fact that he is a god who doesn't really want to be.
Right. I mean, and there's a lot of interesting parallels you can draw there. So on one, it's like you said, he's an interesting entryway. Two, it's like a mirror showing you, like, hey, these new gods are essentially all of these comic book characters, and this is the difference between comic books and reality. And then even on top of that, if you want to go with a religious angle, he's essentially like a Christ figure trying to understand what it's like to live and be like a normal person.
And that comes across a lot in a lot of the art that I've seen from Kirby books, where he's doing a different traps, or he's locked in things, and
yeah,
there's a lot of like that Christian symbology going on.
The crucifixion and stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
Which this book also does have, but it's used in a very tasteless way.
that's a word,
yeah,
that you could use for that, yeah. You know, let's delve into that a little bit more, the reluctant Christ figure aspect of Mr. Miracle. Like we were saying before, he's the son of God. He's the son of the High Father.
Yep.
And they keep trying to kind of push upon him this power and
responsibility.
His responsibility, yeah, to New Genesis and so on and so forth. Fight the wars for us. And he's so reluctant to be part of this. He doesn't want anything to do with it, but he can't help but continue to be sucked back into it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it kind of goes along with the idea that he is this escape artist, right?
Yes.
Because he's constantly trying to escape from being what he is, and it's the one thing that he seemingly can't fully get away from. He
right.
can't fully escape.
Right. And like it causes you to wonder, is this why he tried to kill himself? Was like, what is this, what he was running from in the beginning? Like, is this, and it's definitely why he's escaping to normalcy? Because he, like I said before, it's the way he's trying to get away from. But that's what makes it such an interesting character too, because like, what if you had a Bible, but Jesus about halfway through just looked up and God said, I am done with this crap, like, stick it, old man.
Yeah, it's just like, I don't want to do this, I never wanted this, you wanted me to, I don't want to.
Yeah,
I just want to be a normal dude and live my life, you know, away from all of this, you know, I have no interest.
Yeah, like, think of, like, what changes when that happened? Is humanity saved? What happens? Does the world get better? Does the world get worse? Is it selfish? Is it selfless? Was it wrong for God to expect a child to bear the weight of the world, even if he is the God's child? These are deep theological questions.
Very deep. And it also plays into the idea of destiny, and can you run from things that you are destined to be part of?
Right.
Because as much as Scott tries, he keeps getting pulled back in, and the more he tries to pull away, the worse it gets. You know, he tries to pull away. Orion gets murdered. He's the High Father.
Yeah.
He didn't want to even be part of this, and
right.
Now he is the head of the whole thing.
Yep.
It's such an interesting thing to wrap your mind around with this character, which is what is so great about this book, because you take these, and I understand that Kirby had a lot of high concept in his as well, but you take these characters who look just so cheesy, and they're so like old school comic-y, and you're really just delving into these deep philosophical and ethical dilemmas.
Yeah.
You know?
And to me, the issue that summarizes that whole sequence up perfectly, I think it's issue 8, I want to say. And that's where they start having peace talks with Kalibak.
Oh, that issue is so cool.
That issue is cool on multiple reasons, on multiple levels. In addition to being the issue that has the most Jack Kirby New Gods nods, it's also the issue that kind of lets you, as the best portrayal of peace talks I have ever seen in a visual medium.
Yes, agreed.
Between the part where they're all just sitting around a table going about facts, figures, graphs, timetables.
Especially just looking at giant hulking Kalibak shifting papers around.
Yes.
Discussing agreements. Yeah.
And then you have Light Ray, you know, who is, you know, a typical New Genesis new god, being like, you killed my friends, I'll, you know, burn you, and, you know, all this other stuff.
He goes into full, like, thou wretched knave, you know, going into the full speech about how he's going to destroy them. And then when he's done, they're just like, okay, are you done?
He's like,
sit down.
It's like, shut the hell up, yeah. Light Ray. It's like, the adults are trying to make the war stop. Nobody cares about your little vendettas. We're trying to prevent 20 more vendettas from happening in the next hour.
Yeah. I loved that scene because you get a little look at each of these characters, but it is, again, it's a very normal world thing that they are doing. In typical comic books, all you get is a war, and then there is a big battle that makes the war stop.
Right.
And then it's big and flashy, and then it's over. Yeah, exactly.
It's like a bomb. But that's not how war is.
No, yeah, exactly. There is something that happens. It brings a peace talk in. You negotiate, so on and so forth. And watching these characters do that was so fun, especially Kalibak when he gets angry.
Yeah.
And just, what was that character's name? I don't even remember what it was.
It was a new god.
It was a Q-list new god. And he gets mad and just smashes the guy into the ground.
Oh, and that's where a lot of the side scenery is too, because you also get to see what it's like, what it must feel like for being on the right side of a conflict, but then still having peace talks with an utterly reprehensible monster. Because you have these people going in, and the peace talks table is being held up by chained prisoners of war.
What a crazy visual that was.
Yes.
That just a tabletop with people down on their stomachs, holding the table in place.
And like when Mr. Miracle goes to try and use the bathroom, Kanto, the assassin general, whatever he is, it's like, oh yeah, I'll take you to the bathroom, leads him through the hallway where he sees the head of one of the Forever People, Big Bear, who was like a literal, like that was a main character.
Oh, really?
Of the Forever People.
I was wondering, because I saw the head, I'm like, that's got to be important, but it's not a character that I knew.
Just his head on a pike, casually, and they're talking about, oh, I was in the Renaissance once, you know?
Yeah, and they just walk by, no big deal.
Then they go to this giant abyssal pit that's just supposed to be a toilet. And they're just urinating, and then you follow the bit of spittle down as Kanto kind of hawks a loogie, and it hits yet another one of the Forever People at the bottom of the pit, just in chains, constant. And you're like, there's in a trash pit. There is no value to life here on Apokolips, and these are the people you're having negotiations with.
Wow, it is. It's very powerful stuff, especially now knowing that some of these characters are popping up that are super important or were very important characters, and now they are just garbage.
Yeah.
Or just a head on a pike.
They are numbers on a tally sheet of prisoners and casualties.
And it also does show how messed up Mr. Miracle himself still is, because he is a product of the X-Pit. He's a product of Apokolips, though he's a son of the High Father, but he is a product of Apokolips. And these things don't even affect him.
Right.
Like, going back to what I was saying, when Kalibak just mashes that guy's face into the ground, and he's trying to get a rise out of Scott.
Yeah.
And Scott just looks at him and is just like, don't forget that I am a product of Granny Goodness too.
Yeah.
And that you're not going, basically, you're not going to flex on me.
But here's the thing. And then, yeah, he does that. But at the end, it's still just another face.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, after that, he's going to Barda for strength and composure. He's shivering. His teeth are chattering.
Was that the scene where she's talking to him and he's in the shower just on the ground crying to himself?
No, that was a different.
Was that it later?
That's after the end of the peace talks and what Darkseid decides
yes.
is going to happen.
That's right.
No, so like that's the scene where he's saying like, my teeth are chattering, but they are not chattering if I breathe. And Barr's like, well, then you just got to breathe, honey.
Yeah.
Which is, whew.
Oh my. A little fun thing that I noticed while reading the book also is the frames around all of the blocks.
This book does fantastic things yes. with the 9-panel structure.
And apparently a lot of this was just Mitch Gerads just having ideas and rolling with it, because apparently Tom King would give him the full structure in the blocks of what he wants, but then he would just tell Mitch to go nuts with ideas that he had after that. Well, just the simple use of black and white. So you'll notice some of the pages, the outline of each of all the blocking is white. Some is black, depending on where you're at. Like if you're in Apocalypse or if it's one of the war sections, it's all black. If you're on Earth, you're in New Genesis, it's white. It's very interesting how that works.
I never noticed that.
Oh, yeah?
I honestly never noticed that.
Yeah, it's a really cool little thing that Gerads does. He does, and there's a lot of that little stuff, little nuanced stuff that just adds to the story as it goes on. Like all like the blurring of the, almost like a TV that isn't quite getting the right reception during different sections of the book.
Oh, and the thing that I noticed first and foremost is how some frames, like you always have 9 panels on the page, but certain scenes will take up more of those panels.
Yeah.
And they'll just be carved up. Like the first time we see the female Furies sitting on the bench outside the delivery room, that like you can tell that like they're all kind of blurring or bleeding over into the adjacent panels and stuff.
Right.
Or the first time we actually see Darkseid in full glory, he is just sitting in a chair taking up a third of the page.
Yes. Or the right before the love scene where Scott is is tied to the bed with just the mask covering his bits, and it's the full page. I can't remember who to give credit to, but while I was doing a little bit of research on this, somebody pointed out that the use of the 9 blocks, especially for the full page scenes that they're doing, it also kind of gives you the image of a cage, like he's still trapped. You know, he's trapped behind these bars no matter what, kind of thing.
Yeah, I get it.
I thought that was really interesting as well. But now that you've mentioned Darkseid, who is kind of important. Yes. Who is?
Yeah.
Why don't we talk about that? So during most of this book, every once in a while, you'll get just a black block that just says Darkseid is. Mm-hmm. And that's all that it says. And it seems to happen more and more whenever Scott gets either stressed or down on himself or things are going wrong. There are some specific sections where when Scott is internally dealing with things, when he is in turmoil, there are a lot more Darkseid is blocks. What is your interpretation of that?
So I have two interpretations of this. One is the use of them and like how they're laid out in the book. I think they're a clear metaphor for what it's like to have depression and have your mind betray you. Because every time, like it doesn't happen just when he's, sure it happens more when he's stressed, but even when he's just going about his daily routine, sometimes your brain just comes in and says, hey, you're not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
It's the doubt. It's knowing that out there, like you are here, but out there, Darkseid is. And Darkseid, you have to remember what he stands for. He stands for, he's anti-life, anti-choice, anti-freedom, anti-happiness, anti-growth.
So any feeling, any emotion, any bad thing is Darkseid, therefore Darkseid is.
And he always will be.
Right. I loved the page where he makes a note of it. where I think he just mashed like Scott's face in, and the panel before that is just says Darkseid is, and then the next one is Darkseid saying yes I am.
Yeah,
I thought that was great.
I love that. I also love the panel where after the emotional reveal of what happened to Orion and Mr. Miracle Scott Free asks what did you do. To Darkseid, and Darkseid doesn't look at him. He looks him dead in the eye and says, Darkseid does not do. And then
Darkseid is. Was that the full page one then after that? I can't remember.
I don't remember. I don't think it was.
But that, like the colors for that scene when Scott.
Oh, God, yes.
Because we have to talk about that whole sequence leading up. This is going to be a long episode, folks. Just hang in with us. But I loved that whole scene leading up to that. Where, once again, you show the juxtaposition of the mundane with this over-the-top crazy world of gods, where Barda and Scott are breaking into the palace on Genesis, straight-up murdering guards left and right, blood all over the place. The whole time, the two of them are having a conversation because Barda wants to do some renovations in the house, and just talking about, I think we could use a smaller living room. I want to add an extra bedroom. Let's make this a bathroom. Da da da. And them just going back and forth, and Scott being reluctant, like, do we really need to do that? You know, I like my stuff. With the obvious, like, the final reasoning that she gives is that she is pregnant and they need to make room for a baby.
Right.
And all of this happens while they are going through all of these basically like different trials to get in to Orion.
Yeah, so, you know, Barda's bashing in heads, he's doing his little escape magic. There's some more fun panel play with the crushing room where it just becomes nothing but white space and you don't even see them really escape. They just appear on the next, like, okay, we're through that one.
Mm-hmm. And like a voiceover keeps saying, like, you have entered this room and you are not allowed here. It will crush you now, or it will eat you now, or, you know, whatever is happening.
This very polite new Genesis security system. Be like, come on, do you really need to keep doing this?
All right, well, now the poisonous gas is going to melt you.
Yeah.
And right before going in and finding Orion, he finds out that his wife is pregnant.
Yes.
The scene where he wraps his arms around her and he's so happy.
He's so happy, but he's like, it's going to energize him. He goes in and just sees
his brother, who he claims is not his brother, is dead.
And he sees that Darkseid is.
Yep. I loved the colors when he goes in there, too. It's dark. There's, like, sparse color. It's got kind of, like, a weird reverse film negative, kind of effect, because it's such a poignant, powerful moment. It's the first time we actually really see Darkseid. And you know, he came there. Scott came there to stop Orion and to free himself of bonds that Orion put on him. Finds him dead, and now suddenly realizes, it seems like in that moment he realizes that he did kind of care for this guy, even though he hates him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I just remembered. The full-scale Darkseid is, that comes from the reveal on what Darkseid wants of Mr. Miracle's son.
Oh, of course. Yes. Yeah, which is to stop the war. He wants his only grandchild.
Yeah, which, and that's just the perfect stinger on that. Just full page. Bam, there's no getting out of this. It's oppressive and it takes up everything.
Yeah, it's perfect for that moment because that's so huge. Imagine having to make a decision like that where you will save millions and millions of lives. You will end a brutal, brutal war, but the only way to do it is to give the one thing you truly love away to, like we were talking about before, these despicable, terrible creatures.
Yeah. And not even just that, but also, in addition to that, go completely against your entire character and give in to the responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because, you know, that's what he's been doing that entire time. Like, every action that book has been leading up to, or in that this book is leading up to, is like him assuming more responsibility and more responsibility. And
trying to escape from
and
it.
And breaking down slowly and slowly, bit by bit. And what it does to him is just killing him on the inside. And the only thing keeping him going is his son. And then he gives it away. They want him to give his child away, and like that's it. After that, there's nothing.
Mm-hmm. We could go on and on.
Oh God, yeah.
With this book, it is so well written, and there is so much to it. It's not often in comic books where you get to discuss things like subtext, symbolism, and get to this kind of depth and this kind of gritty ooh, like reality.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's, or even there's a literal page where like it's nothing but a did you notice the parallels with Funky Flashman being the maid and Genius Jack?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because they named the son Jacob, and, you know, Flashman calls him Jack.
Yeah.
Did you hear about the stories that Jack and I were making?
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's great. This book will make you smile. This book will make you wince. This book will make you weep.
There is a lot of uneasiness in this book. Mm-hmm. It really is. There are a lot of very uneasy things to look at. And ideas to postulate. One more scene that it really gripped me was while out doing war, on the battlefield, Scott is basically on his Bluetooth talking to Barda back on Earth, who's watching the baby, or vice versa.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, while, because they take turns going to war so the other one can stay home with Jacob. That scene where you're on this battlefield, there's just bodies. And Scott is just beaten and his mask is off and he is singing over his comm or over his mother box, which is his phone, to the baby hush, little baby, don't, you know, and he just drops to his knees. And this is amidst having to come to terms with whether or not they will give the child away. And oh, man, what a powerful, powerful sequence of boxes.
Yeah.
Well, and. Is there anything that we didn't touch on that you think is important for people to hear about?
Tons.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
I will say this. When you pick up this book, and you will pick up this book, dear listener, pay attention to two things and kind of just take note of them as you go through. Pay attention to Big Barda's eyes.
Oh, yes.
And pay attention to the shirts that Mr. Miracle wears when he's not Mr. Miracle.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about that for a second. I was trying to close this out, but that is a good thing to point out. He's always wearing a different superhero shirt.
Yep.
Yeah.
And there are two points in this book where that's actually kind of relevant, and I think actually is story points. He only wears a Mr. Miracle themed shirt when he's out drinking with the boys, Blue Beetle and Booster Gold. Which I also appreciated how even Skeets got drunk.
Yeah, I loved that sequence. As a huge Booster Gold mark, I fully enjoyed that.
And the point where he breaks the news to Big Barda that he's thinking about taking up Darkseid on the offer, he's wearing a reverse Flash shirt.
Oh, man. I did not even catch on to that.
Yeah.
That's good. And it, in a way, seeing all the, like, when you see and hear about heroes, in this book, mm-hmm. It's all products.
Yes.
It's never the actual heroes themselves. It's just products.
Yep. And a Batman plushie.
Batman plushie or a cake or balloons and stuff or the t-shirts. And that really... Because
that's all heroes are to normal people.
Yeah. Which I thought was a nice nod to him just wanting to be a normal guy. He doesn't think of himself in the same way. Like, he's worked in the Justice League, but mm-hmm. he doesn't think of that kind of stuff.
Yep.
All right, cool.
Yeah, I love this book. I cannot say... Words fail to express. Like, we sat here and traded them for almost an hour now. I still can't espouse how much I love this book.
I did not expect it. I had heard
Neither
so many...
I. Yeah.
Yeah, I had heard so many good things about the book. But when... just looking at some of the covers and seeing the character and what he looks like... Not at all what I was expecting to pick up. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was really shocking when I turned that page over and saw him with his wrists cut.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what was coming.
Yeah.
And I was so pleasantly surprised. I expected it to be a fun read, to be a good read. I did not expect to be so utterly blown away and to have such thought-provoking conversation about it as I have in the week or so since I read it.
Yep.
Anyone out there who has not checked it out, Tom King, Mitch Gerads, Mr. Miracle, absolutely worth your time. You can pick it up in collected. It's only 12 issues, right? It was like a maxi series.
Something like that, like 11 or 12.
11 or 12 issues. 12. It's collected, and it's totally worth your time.
Absolutely.
Thanks for being on the show, man.
Thanks for inviting me.
So before we go, why don't you go ahead and tout your wares? Tell people where they can hear you.
Oh, I don't care.
Clearly, that is the name of your podcast.
It is. Beyond Caring. Look up Beyond Caring Podcast. You'll find us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher. I haven't signed us up for Spotify because that takes effort. but I also, if you find our feed, I do have other shows like, what's that one?
Oh, that one.
Yeah. No, Doing It Wrong, the IT usability miniseries.
So that's where you, like a cluster of you try out really crappy technology and see how it works.
Yep. Joy of Dating, which is something I started recently and only got a couple episodes in, which is kind of interesting. It talks about like dating in the modern age and in your 30s. And also Dollar Binema, where our good friend of the podcast, Sam Wyatt, and I review only movies that neither of us have seen that he finds at dollar stores. And, I just actually put up a trio of episodes that where he got one of those 3-in-1 collections for a dollar and
okay,
hoo boy,
it's rough.
Two of them are, the other one is utter insanity, but yeah.
But all of those shows are under the same umbrella of yes, Beyond Caring
of
podcast.
The Beyond Caring Media Network, as it were.
Very nice. And that, my friends, was episode 1 of The Comics That We Love. If you'd like to hear more from me, I've got another podcast called TFD Nerdcast that I host with my buddy Chad, where we talk all things news and rumors in the nerd/pop culture landscape, as well as review movies, video games, and other fun media. There's an explicit tab on that, so maybe wear headphones at work and around the kids, probably. I'm also available on both Twitter and Instagram at @Z_Irish_Red, and you can email me at comicsthatwelove@gmail.com if you've got ideas for future episodes. I run a little website called tfdnerdcast.com with lots of interesting blogs in the many spheres of the nerd multiverse, and if you like my content, please share the show. Make sure to spread the word and help us grow. Look forward to lots of other great episodes in the weeks to come, folks. You're going to enjoy it. Until then, keep reading, keep dreaming. Peace.